rounding up what's going down all around the continent. It's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello, listener. Thanks for joining us today. In the studio, we've got Julien Laurent.
Bonjour.
Alvaro Romeo.
Hola.
James Horncastle.
Hello.
Who's just back from the Milan derby. And Raphael Honigstein. How's he back, Raf?
Been better.
Oh, dear. Did you enjoy the football at least this weekend?
I did. The football was good. Yeah, it was great.
Excellent. There were some big games, some crazy things going on. Alvaro, I really enjoyed your tweet midway through Sunday afternoon when you put out the top of the table in the Liga. Which contained none of the big three.
Yeah, well, Real Madrid won at Sevilla, and then all that changed a little bit, but it's quite remarkable that there are clubs like Athletic de Bilbao, Granada, and Real Sociedad, that they are up there after five games. I would say that it doesn't show a tendency, but Barcelona, Real Madrid, and Atletico are not that powerful yet.
We shall see what happens there. A tiny little PSG leading the way now in Ligue 1, and we'll hear about their Sunday night exploits after this.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Angel Di Maria, Neymar! Et voilà! Voilà le providentiel du Paris Saint-Germain!
Jules, France. Angers in second place.
Incredible, yeah.
Got Nice Monaco coming up on Tuesday. Monaco's still in big trouble. And maybe a word or two on Marseille. But let's talk about Sunday night's biggie down in Lyon. As Paris Saint-Germain, fresh from that whopping 3-0 win over Real Madrid, came to town. And it was another late Neymar winner.
Exactly like he did against Strasbourg, with a lovely goal again. The kind of goal that only he can score. And a phenomenal individual effort, if you want, in the box with three defenders on his back. He managed to turn around and then hit it with his left foot. And it's just crazy again that he misses the Real Madrid game, which is probably one of the most accomplished performances by a PSG team under Thomas Tuchel, but also a PSG team full stop since the Qatari took over. And then he comes back. There's a few more injuries. No Icardi, for example, still no Cavani,
what
no Mbappe.
To Icardi?
He just had a little, I think, calf problem against Real Madrid where he played for an hour. Did quite well, I thought, considering he's
what
short
kept
off.
Kept him out the second half of last season.
Yes.
Right.
And then Neymar is back, and when Neymar is in that kind of form, even if the game was not always easy, he got a lot of stick from the fans. Every time he was going to take a corner, he was pelted with like plastic glasses and pieces of paper and
by
all that stuff,
fans.
Insults and everything.
By the Lyon fans.
By the Lyon fans, yeah.
Right.
And he was kicked around a lot by the Lyon defenders, but yet he came out at the end and scored that incredible goal. Lyon being quite a buggy team for PSG because they lost five times since 2011 when the Qatari took over. They lost five times to Lyon, and the last two visits at the Parc OL or the Groupama Stadium, Neymar was injured each time, so he'd never actually played himself in Lyon. And you know, if he had gone to Barcelona, would have never played in Lyon, which would have been a shame, but better for them. But he came out with that incredible goal to win the game for Paris.
It's a silver lining for him that is for that move to Barcelona not going through, that he can at last take the field at the Grouparama Stadium. Una Pal Balder says, is Neymar still in PSG fans' bad books after yet another late winner?
So it was interesting this time. They chose to completely ignore anything that happened. So they ignored him, basically. There was a bit more than 1,000 ultras at the ground, and he scored, and they didn't sing his name or they didn't insult him either. I guess that's a progress. They sounded indifferent more than anything else, really, more than still angry. And there's a home game on Thursday night against Reims at the Parc des Princes. And I guess everyone will see how they welcome him back again to the Parc des Princes after, you know, after the last few games they had. But against Real Madrid, they could have, again, gone on to the attack on him at the Parc des Princes. He was there in his box with Mbappe and his dad, and they didn't. So it might be a bit more peaceful on Thursday night when they play against Reims at the Parc des Princes.
Okay, 1-0 win anyway on Sunday against a Lyon team that failed to have a single shot on target. The first time that's happened at home since Opta started analysing Ligue 1. Why were they so bad, Lyon?
That was the game plan from Silvinho. They chose not to attack, pretty much. They chose to play with five men at the back, to be very defensive, very cautious, which again, goes against their own DNA, their own philosophy, especially at home. They've always attacked. They beat PSG, like I said, the last two seasons, for example. They're usually very good at taking the game away from PSG and making it really hard for them, play quite physical, and there was none of that last night. I thought it was so disappointing from Silvinho to have chosen that way, from the way the players played that game. And if you had been a Lyon fan in that stadium against PSG, when you know how good you usually are against them, to have a known performance like that, a known game, not even trying to score, not even trying to attack, I think you would have been absolutely livid with your manager. And I don't know where this is going, but right now the whole Silvinho-Juninho partnership, the new idea, the new philosophy with Olas, the owner and chairman, taking a step down and, you know, not being as present and as vocal as he used to before, it's just not working. They haven't won in five games in all competitions. You know, they haven't won in four in the league, plus the game in the Champions League as well, where they got lucky in many ways to get a point against Zenit in midweek. It's just, yeah, I just can't work it out where they're going, and I think it's quite worrying.
PSG, meanwhile, are top 3 points clear of Angers and Nice. Nice, who've got the Tuesday night game with Monaco, who are still without a win. Angers, how much of a surprise is it to see them up there?
It's a huge surprise for them. The great thing they have is how they every year manage to sell their best players for huge profit, like they did this summer again with Jeff Rennes-Adelaide, who they got from Arsenal for hardly no money and sold to Lyon for around 30 million euros. And yet they replace him. They find another way to be strong. They take a gamble on Casimir Ninga, who was a promising player when he arrived at Montpellier and then lost his way a little bit and then scores a hat-trick in 11 minutes at the weekend. And meant that Angers took over Nice for second place. The story about Nice was Kasper Dolberg, you know, who came from Ajax. So he scored at the weekend for his first goal for the club, and they have a lot of hope for him because they've needed a striker for a long time. And so that was Saturday. On Monday, he got his watch stolen in the dressing room, a watch that was worth 70,000 euros, which is a very expensive watch. No one knows where the watch is. He apparently threatened to not train and not play until someone brought the watch back. It's clearly someone it's not the cleaner just walking in and only taking his watch, because nothing else disappears, which is a very strange story.
Okay.
But if anyone knows where Kasper Dolberg's watch
is, it hasn't arrived yet, the watch. It hasn't been returned.
Not yet.
So as it stands, he won't take the field.
So he did in the end. They convinced him to did. But there was a point on Monday where he said, I'm not training. Where's my watch? What's this? I've just joined the club. What is this club where watches disappear?
You'd hope that anyone who's stolen it does some time for it.
Whoa.
Oh, God. This is a great start.
Was it just a wind-up or not? Anyway.
Was he ticked off?
Oh, my God. We have to stop there.
So, just 1 point back from Angers-Nice. A Marseille. André Villas-Boas's Marseille. They drew 1-1 with Montpellier. I see that there were three red cards in stoppage time, including one for Dimitri Payet. What happened there?
Yeah, he insulted the referee, so got sent off. Jordan Ferry from Montpellier got sent off as well for slapping in the face one of the Marseille players. And Bouba Camara got involved and got sent off as well. There was a big brawl. Marseille should have won that game. They were by far the better side. They were very good again, I thought. And I think Villas-Boas is doing a really good job there. And they were frustrated, I think, to only get a point towards the end. It was quite obvious. Ferry, really got everyone going as well. And then Villas-Boas got mad at the referee in the tunnel because the referee refused to speak to him and to let him enter his dressing room. And Villas-Boas just went mad and said, you ruined the game. How come you don't even want to talk to me? You don't want to let me in? And I think he got a point. I think referees should stop hiding behind the fact that they are above everyone else, because they're not really. And when something like this happened, I think it would be good for them to open up and just meet the captains or just the managers and explain what happened, explain why you put your cards out and things like that. But I think Villas-Boas and the Marseille players were right to be frustrated.
Interesting. Another interesting story from France, I saw, is that the French Federation has decided to get rid of La Coupe de la Ligue.
Yes, finally, after 26 years. It was just not working.
Right.
It was not working.
So this is the French League Cup.
Yeah, so your Carabao Cup, basically.
Yeah.
And it was created for a way of, going into Europe. If you win it, you go into the Europa League, like in any other leagues, to make a bit more money, I think, with TV rights and everything. It's just not working. They couldn't sell the TV rights, for the next 3 years. And clubs were not that keen. And it was either you get rid of that, or you go the league down to 18 clubs instead of 20 to make a bit more room, to make the schedule and the calendar a bit better for every club. And they decided to scrap it, which I think is a good... We've had good moments, and PSG won it many times.
Right.
So we sad to see it go, but it was the right decision.
Okay. Anything else, Jules?
Just maybe a quick word on Leodano Jardim, who only got a point at Reims that bought him a bit of time. But there's, like you said, the derby against Nice on Tuesday night, which I think could see him get sacked.
If they
were losing. Which, in a way, he got sacked last October.
And he got a payoff of how much?
Around 8 million euros paycheck for that.
And then hired again.
3 months later with a pay rise and literally full power at the club.
Uh-huh.
And he could get sacked again in September. So after coming back in January. And this time he'd probably be around 10 million euros. I want to be a Monaco football manager. If I
want you to, Jules.
Yes, that would be nice.
And you might be in with a shout. Who are they going to go for?
So... it looks like the shortlist could be Claude Puel, Max Allegri, who I think might not come, but it's the kind of caliber they would like to go for. I think they could probably try Jose Mourinho as well. Again, it doesn't mean that it would work, but I think their link with Jorge Mendes is so strong that...
Monaco?
I think, yeah. Jorge Mendes has a lot of involvement in that club still now.
Okay.
And, you know, I think Laurent Blanc, those kind of people who are still looking for a good club to get into project with, how good would it be if Arsene Wenger got that job?
Wow, wouldn't that be amazing?
All those years
full
later.
Circle.
Oh, I would love that.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking a second or two about some other clubs that might be interested in Max Allegri and Jose Mourinho as we turn our thoughts to La Liga.
It seems as though Serie A is a bit of a dumping ground these days, doesn't it? Where all the Premier League's footballing flumps are sent to get them off the wage bill. It's literally a weekly reminder for Man United of all their very expensive mistakes. But thankfully, with Paddy Power's money back specials, not all your mistakes cost you as much. Get money back as a free bet on football every week. See on site for the latest. Paddy Power, home of the money back special. Selected markets only. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Premier Sports, the home of Liga and Serie A in the UK, has 11 live midweek games and 15 games at the weekend, including the Madrid derby. Premier Sports is available for just £11.99 for Sky and Premier Player customers and also available on Virgin TV. All right then, Alvaro, let's hear about that Liga. Ooh, that's a bit of... Athletic Bilbao's theme. What a magnificent tune that is. And you're top of the table, Alvaro.
Yeah, and it's unbelievable because in a year, everything has changed for Athletic de Bilbao. I think that last season it took them 14 games to get 11 points, and they've got 11 points now after 5 games, which is quite remarkable. And they haven't lost at home since October 2018. So they are definitely a solid team. And yesterday in the Basque Derby, they beat Alaves, to the team of the capital of the Basque Country, which is a bit strange that Vitoria is the capital of the Basque Country, being the smallest city, but that is another story. But Athletic de Bilbao won that derby, and they are leading the table altogether with Real Madrid, which is really, really good because Athletic haven't been there at this stage of the season since 1993, when Jupp Heynckes was the manager of Athletic de Bilbao.
Wow, extraordinary. Real Madrid, as you say, up there with them, but behind on goal difference. Then you've got Granada, Real Sociedad, Sevilla and Atletico Madrid all level on points. What's going on? In general, we'll talk about Barcelona, what's happening to them, but why have you got so many lesser fancied teams or less fancied teams up in the top positions?
Well, it happened last season as well, until Barcelona started winning many games. At the beginning of the season, we had a little bit of a strange top of the table with teams that you wouldn't expect to be there. But I think that this is due to a couple of things. Number one, that the TV share is much more fair than it was like six,
the
7 years ago.
The sharing of the TV revenue.
The sharing of the TV revenue, yes. It's much more fair than it was 10 years ago. And also, I think that the Barcelona and the Real Madrid great cycle is kind of over.
Wow.
In the sense that Cristiano Ronaldo left Real Madrid, and Real Madrid haven't been able to recover from the impact of losing Cristiano Ronaldo. And Barcelona, they... don't go for excellence anymore. It's simple as that. I mean, in the past 10 years ago, they considered themselves the Apple of football, and they were doing many good things, like recruiting before anyone else, having a philosophy, having a sporting director who was on the same page as the manager. Uh-huh. And Barcelona doesn't have all that now. In fact, Barcelona doesn't have a sporting director now because he was sacked this summer. Barcelona doesn't have a vice president because he resigned this summer. And Ernesto Valverde is quite contested at the minute.
Well, absolutely.
Many things are not working, and everything is down to what Lionel Messi does on the pitch. And Lionel Messi hasn't had a pre-season, and he's not fit yet.
Okay. So this weekend, Barcelona went to Granada, newly promoted Granada.
Yeah.
Barely managed two shots on target and lost 2-0.
Goal del Granada que estalla en la celebración.
Messi coming on in the second half and making very little difference indeed.
Yeah, the game started really bad. In the first minute, Granada scored the goal because Junior Firpo, one of these very questionable signings of Barcelona, made a mistake leading to Granada's first goal, and the second goal came right after. And Barcelona was just not there. You could see that the three midfielders that Barcelona have, for instance, they don't play to the same thing. Rakitic, De Jong, Busquets, Artur, they all play very differently. In the past, Busquets, Iniesta, Xavi, they all played for the same thing because they came from the same academy. I'm not saying that Barcelona should be taking hostage of nostalgia or anything like that, but they should have a plan, at least. And it seems that Barcelona this summer, they have tried to sign the best players around, but still they haven't found the style yet.
Right.
And I think that Liverpool in many ways showed the way last season to the rest of the clubs. If you go for them, if you go for Barcelona, and if you make the game difficult for them, and you don't wait for them, but if you go for them up front pressing, Barcelona has a hell of a problem to start playing, and whenever they feel uncomfortable, they don't know how to suffer.
Right. Well, they narrowly avoided defeat away at Dortmund in the Champions League last week. They got the joint worst defensive record in the Liga. They've taken 7 points from a possible 15, which is their worst start for a quarter of a century. Can Valverde survive this?
I think that the problem of Barcelona, and there is an agreement on this, is multi-organic. It's not only Valverde, the main problem of Barcelona. Of course, he will be the same scapegoat if Barcelona keeps on losing, but there will be a little bit of patience. Historically, Barcelona hasn't sacked many managers in the past. I think that the last one to be sacked, I would say that it was in 2003, before Frank Rijkaard. Radomir Antic, the likes of Luis Enrique, the likes of Guardiola, the likes of Frank Rijkaard left. They weren't sacked at the time. So I think the patience is something that Barcelona chooses to have.
Okay.
And I believe that they will be patient with Ernesto Valverde, but at the same time, Barcelona has to start winning as soon as possible. What happened in Granada is unacceptable. And with Valverde, normally Barcelona relied on consistency. In the 2017-18 season, they lost one league game. Last season, I think they lost 3 league games, which is still a really good thing. This season, they have already lost 2 games.
I think there's a problem with Griezmann as well, in the sense that it's only 5 games, so he needs maybe a bit more time to adapt and etc. But the way he's playing, which is out of position, because they're playing either right winger or left winger, now that Suarez and Suarez is back and Messi will be back very soon. I think they, in the touches per 90 minutes since the start of the season, is third from bottom. Only Suarez, who was injured for most of it. And I think Ter Stegen, I've touched the ball less than him. Even the kids like Carles Perez and those kind of people, Carles Alenia, I think as well, has touched the ball more than Antoine Griezmann since the start of the season. Mm. So he clearly is not already integrated in the passing and the movement and etc. And if you have a player like that up front and you don't use him, it's crazy.
Mm. What about Granada, meanwhile, who won the game 2-0? Last I remember, they were being managed by Tony Adams, and it was a bold kind of project that they were taking us into the future with.
Yeah, well, they seem to be fine now. I mean, they've got a really good manager.
Tony's not there anymore.
Tony Adams, as far as I know,
right,
is not there. He's been replaced by Diego Martinez, okay, who seems to be a good manager, who, in his first season in charge of the club, managed to promote Granada to the top flight. And they've got 3 players, very experienced ones, that they are obviously very well remembered. One of them is the French Gona Longs. The other one, Roberto Soldado, former Spurs striker, mm-hmm, and Adrián Ramos, he was the striker for Borussia Dortmund, not very good one, but he was there. They've got a mix of youth and experience, and they score many goals. This season they have scored already 11, so they are playing with plenty of bravery in the top flight, considering that they are just promoted. Yeah, and this is their best ever start to a top flight season. So congratulations to them. Really good. And they have had a really difficult calendar, playing, for example, against Villarreal as well. And they managed to get an astonishing 4-all draw against them.
Wow. Okay, well, they're up in third at the moment. Real Madrid just ahead of them after that massive win. I mean, it was actually a narrow win, but in a massive game on Sunday night, Real Madrid visiting Sevilla, whose manager Lopetegui is the manager they sacked at the start of last season. There'd been a lot of talk going into this about time being up for Zinedine Zidane, the Real Madrid manager, after the defeat in Paris on, when was that, Tuesday or Wednesday?
Wednesday.
As Thomas Roncero saying, it's over. how real was is still the danger for Zidane?
Well, I think that this victory is very soothing for Real Madrid, very important for them. I wouldn't say that Zinedine Zidane won't be sacked in 3-4 weeks if Real Madrid gets already bad results again. But the loss in Paris was very, very difficult to handle because they lost 3-0 and PSG didn't have some of their biggest stars on the pitch either. And Real Madrid was definitely worse than PSG were. But I think that this time they played against Sevilla, a team that, even though they were leading the table, they have some structural problems. For example, they don't have any quick players. If they want to play counter-attacks, that doesn't make any sense. And they don't have a good striker yet, because De Jong doesn't seem to be that guy who can replace and make forget Wissam Ben Yedder, who was a terrific striker for Sevilla. Right. But anyway, winning at Sevilla is a really important thing for Real Madrid, because they get now 11 points, and the main reason why, in a way, Valverde and Zinedine Zidane are not getting more stick is because Real Madrid and Barcelona aren't doing too well recently, neither Atletico de Madrid. So the weaknesses of the other teams are making it easier to handle its own crisis to Real Madrid and Barcelona.
Right, okay. Speaking of crisis, quick word on Valencia, who were surprise winners at Stamford Bridge last midweek, held to a 1-1 draw by Leganés on Sunday amid fierce protests from the fans at owner Peter Lim. The fans kicking off over the sacking of Marcelino, and how do you see this situation playing out?
Well, I think that I saw Albert Celades in the press conference after the Chelsea-Valencia game, and he didn't seem to be the Valencia leader yet. He seemed to be a guy who was just landed and he was trying to understand the situation. I don't think that it helps the fact that when he gave his first press conference in Stamford Bridge, the Valencia captain Parejo wasn't with him,
right,
because he decided not to be there as a way of sending a statement to Peter Lim, Valencia owner. But I think that it was very positive that when Celades was getting a bit criticized during the game against Leganés and the Valencia fans were chanting in favor of Marcelino, the likes of Rodrigo and the likes of Parejo asked the supporters to shut up and to get behind the team. So I think that the Celades situation is not easy for Valencia. He's a manager that obviously comes there, but the players want another manager to be there, but they have to move on. And they got a really important victory against Chelsea the other day, so they have to build from that point.
Absolutely. Valencia currently lying all the way down in 12th place right now in the Liga. Very interesting. Next up, Rafa, how about we spend some time with the Bundesliga?
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Wow. Rafa, it sounds like Oktoberfest is underway.
It is in full swing, James, and I will be there on Tuesday night.
Are you going out there?
Yeah.
Be careful of that back, hey.
Is there any football on?
Tuesday night? No, I think so.
You're not well enough to travel and to drink and party.
After the drink, I will be well enough.
Prost. Bayern have kicked off Oktoberfest in style, haven't they?
They did. They celebrated a very comfortable and ultimately convincing 4-0 win over Köln, FC Cologne, on Saturday. And it was your usual sort of Bayern performance where big moments were interspersed with moments where the team as a team didn't look all that convincing. So really the classic Kovac game, if you will. Strong going forward, strong in terms of individual quality, but still leaving you with a sense that as a team is not really functioning all that well. Ultimately, of course, doesn't really matter when you win 4-0, when you beat Red Star 3-0 in midweek. It was the perfect week for Bayern. And something absolutely amazing happened. Robert Lewandowski, on a hat-trick, gave the ball for a penalty kick to Philippe Coutinho. And no one can believe it. Still a couple of days later, people are sort of pinching themselves thinking, did this really happen? Lewandowski, of all people. But to his credit, he said, we wanted to give him a feeling that he's now one of us. It's important for new players to belong. And he allowed Coutinho to open his account. Thinking that, I'm going to get lots of through balls and lots of payback coming up. But it was a very touching and very unusual gesture from one of the more self-centered centre forwards.
I mean, it's a self-centered position, isn't it, the striker?
It is.
I have to say, that analysis of Kovac Bayern, it sounds like most football to me, like good bits.
To you, yes, but no, other, but people, other people like to look beyond the highlights,
most
James.
People's teams, no, that's not what I'm saying, it's quite the opposite. Most people's teams, they would say that's entirely normal to have the odd good bits followed by, interspersed with long bits when the team's not...
I mean,
really.
You make a valid point, and I think the problem is that Kovac's Bayern, just like Ancelotti's Bayern, is still up against Guardiola's and Heinke's Bayern to a certain extent. They're still in the shadow of these teams. Yes, Guardiola didn't win the Champions League, but they regularly put in performances that this Bayern team since can only dream of in terms of sort of complete levels of excellence that, just hadn't been seen before. For example, the Roma game is one, or the 3-1 game against Manchester City. This Bayern team are still some way off. But I think what is reassuring after a very noisy and sort of uncomfortable transfer window, there is quality there. The question is sort of, can they bring it all together when it really matters in February and March? And can they keep it going in a league that is more difficult this year? Because it looks as if we have not just one, but two genuine contenders for the title this
year. Right, Bayern currently lying second, 2 points behind RB Leipzig, who had a mighty 3-0 win away at Werder Bremen.
They were really impressive because they weren't quite on their game, but still managed to win quite easily, which is always, I think, the hallmark of a team that you have to take very seriously. Bremen were very depleted, had a lot of injuries. Leipzig were a little bit off, coming back from that Benfica win, which was very important for them away in Lisbon. But they had some great set ball routines. They scored a beautiful goal with Sabitzer, a fantastic free kick, and then they managed the game really impressively, like in the manner of a top side. And ultimately, the gulf in class was just unbridgeable as far as Werder were concerned. And, all the players and Nagelsmann were all asked about, where is this going? And you could sense that they didn't want to sort of be honest, but at the same time, what came across in the answers was that there is a genuine belief that they can continue doing this because, they already drew against Bayern, the worst game they could possibly have, although Albedo was at home. All other teams, with the exception of Dortmund, look inferior. So let's see how far they can take it. But it's good for the league, and it's also quite reassuring, I think, for everyone who's been hyping up Nagelsmann a little bit, and I would count myself in that in that camp, because he seems to be doing what he did at Hoffenheim, which is to improve a team immediately, which is very, very impressive.
Good stuff. Dortmund, lying in third place, stumbled again this weekend, a 2-2 draw away at Eintracht Frankfurt. This is the same Frankfurt that couldn't even score against Arsenal, Rafa.
Yeah, Frankfurt were a little bit lucky against Arsenal. They created a few chances. Arsenal's chances were better, and Arsenal were much more efficient. Dortmund had enough chances to do to Eintracht what Arsenal had done to them a few days before, but it just didn't take them. And they kind of sleepwalked into this second half performance where they lost a little bit of control and ultimately saw a really silly goal being conceded later on. The inevitable question about mentality and psychological frailty came up, and it was quite telling that Marco Reus took it very personally and said, this rubbish talk about mentality, I can't hear it anymore. This is has nothing to do with that. And you kind of sympathize with them. But of course, until Dortmund do it and until Dortmund see out these kind of games, that would always be the easy accusation level at them, that they're somehow sort of deficient when it comes to being resilient. It was disappointing because of a completely needless way of throwing away 2 points, which looked in the bag until 3 or 4 minutes before the end.
One of five teams there level 3 points behind Leipzig. So it's pretty tight at the top, hey?
It is very tight because, with the exception of Leipzig, who've only dropped 2 points, and that was against Bayern in that draw, none of the bigger sides have been really consistent. Bayern have already drawn 2 games. Dortmund have lost 1 game, drawn one. So with only 5 games in, the top of the table is much more compact and as you say, much more congested, but in a good way.
In a good way. Meantime, what's the latest score in the big Tesch-Degen-Neuer battle?
I think even the Bayern players were a little bit embarrassed because what happened after the Red Star game was right. that Uli Hoeneß, the Bayern president, took up the opportunity to complain about Tesch-Degen's very vocal disappointment for not playing for Germany, about the fact that he said the South German press haven't been supportive enough of our player, whereas the West German press, he meant geographically, not politically, have been really supportive of Ter Stegen. Of course, he played at Gladbach in that area before. And it was one of those sort of really old school, you know, we will not allow our player to be damaged sort of thing. But it seemed so over the top because Ter Stegen's comments were fairly innocuous. You know, he spoke of his disappointment. And Neuer said, it's not really down to Marc-Andre to talk about this. And then Marc-Andre said, well, Neuer shouldn't really talk about my feelings. But that was really the extent of it. And they made such a big deal out of it that, as I said, even Joshua Kimmich, after the game on Saturday, said, you know what? I mean, I don't think that Ter Stegen actually said anything really badly here. So it's a little bit sort of the goalkeeping wars of the late 90s and the 2006 and 7s, you know, with Kahn and Lehmann being replayed, but at a time where people are kind of thinking, this is a little bit over the top.
Yeah, and we want the players to say something meaningful every time they speak. And when Marc-André Ter Stegen talks respectfully about someone else, I don't think that there should be any censorship by anyone, especially because I think that the Bayern Munich professional shouldn't be... That is not the job of a Bayern Munich professional, just to make someone shut up.
They see it as their job to protect their player and to put pressure on the German FA to keep playing Neuer instead of Ter Stegen. And that is Uli Hoeneß's very old school understanding of what a president should do, you know, protect his players all the time. It might be counterproductive because Joachim Löw is now no more tempted to stick with Neuer than he would have been otherwise, which... You know, Neuer's place is pretty much guaranteed until the Euros. Then we have to see what happens after. Neuer might retire. It might not be even an issue until then. But I think this came very much as a result of Ter Stegen's really strong performance in Dortmund, when he was really the key reason why Barcelona escaped with a point. And also, which is something that wasn't really talked about, Mats Hummels playing really well in that game. Because basically, I think from Bayern's perspective, it kind of casts shadow and a little bit of doubt on some of their decisions, especially letting Hummels go to one of their direct rivals.
A quick word on the other Bundesliga, by the way, Rafa, where RB Salzburg, fresh from their Champions League exploits, beating Genk 6-2 with, of course, a hat-trick from the incredible Erling Haaland, this week only drew 2-2 with Linz, and Haaland was on the bench. Going on there? By the way, speaking of Genk, they're doing badly in Belgium in seventh place, but not nearly as badly as Vincent Kompany's Anderlecht. They're now on 1-8. They got beaten by Club Bruges at the weekend. Belgian football update tick. Next up, we're off to Italy.
If you're listening to this episode of the Totally Football Show and thinking, I wish I was as suave and sophisticated as those European fancy dams, Rafa, Jules and Alvaro, and I wish I could rock the Italian look as well as Jimbo and James H, well, head on over to StitchFix.com. StitchFix is an online personal stylist service that takes the work out of dressing well. They collaborate with all your favourite continental brands like French Connection, Just Cavalli and Tiger of Sweden, and it is super easy. All you have to do is sign up at stitchfix.com, answer a few questions about your style, your size, your shape and your budget, and then book a delivery date for your box of clothes handpicked by one of their stylists. You try everything on at home so you can mix and match your stuff with the rest of your wardrobe. You only keep what you want and send back what you don't. Delivery is free both ways. All you pay is a one-off stylist fee of £10, which is used against any of the clothes you then buy. Try it for yourself on the Stitch Fix app or at stitchfix.com/totally. That's stitchfix.com/totally. You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
James, you're just back from San Siro, you crazy thing.
Well, San Siro was Saturday night, James.
Oh, yeah, and then you went to Bologna-Roma.
I did indeed.
Wow, what a weekend. All right, tell us about San Siro first of all, because it looked amazing. The stadium, the soon-to-be-much-missed stadium, probably, decked out in all the colours you could want.
Yeah, I think you're probably going to still have 6 years.
Six?
Of San Siro.
Right.
Because they've got the Winter Olympics, haven't they? Milano Cortina. And they want to do the opening closing ceremonies at San Siro.
Okay. Because the presentation of the new project, at least they're going to decide, apparently, on which project they're going with. On Tuesday, it's due to be announced.
They're making a final decision. I know that there's a launch planned for this week where the stadium plans are all going to come out, Inter and Milan collaborating, of course, on this. So that's what I'm aware of.
And they're talking about 3 years to build the new place next door to the current San Siro. But yeah, as you say, the Winter Olympics is the X factor in all of that.
But the atmosphere was incredible.
Right.
Great choreography, even by the Milan Kulvesud standards. Mm. Less so from Inter. But ultimately, the only thing that Milan won all night, I suppose, was that choreography, because the team did not show up.
Lukaku! Ha raddoppiato l'Inter. Esattamente al minuto 33, nel corso del secondo tempo, Romelu Lukaku.
Very disappointing from Milan, who have only scored 2 goals so far this season, only one from open play. And when you look at the start that they've had, couldn't have really been any easier for Marco Giampaolo, the new manager, because they had two of the newly promoted clubs, Brescia and Hellas Verona, and they also played Udinese, who the last couple of years have tended to be fighting against relegation. And I think one of the reasons why the criticism of Giampaolo has been quite severe in the aftermath of this defeat is that Milan are not in Europe. He's had all week to prepare, whereas Inter didn't. They were involved in the Champions League. He's had more time to integrate the 6 new faces. And again, we only see one of them starting. And even though they're playing this kind of 4-4-2 diamond, which we all associate Giampaolo with, we're certainly not seeing Milan play with the same style that his Sampdoria sides did. Not create any chances, really. Mm. And the chances that do come are not from the team playing well, consolidated spells of good possession. Their players essentially capitalising on mistakes and then counter-attacking and carrying the ball up the pitch and then not really knowing what to do with it. So Giampaolo, again, I think afterwards, I was worried watching his press conference because he was asked, do you think you can finish fourth? And he said,
do you think you can even finish, I think is the question right now. Can you even eat your panettone?
Well, this is the problem that he's got to face, because the fixtures are coming thick and fast between now and the next international break in October. And the difficulty rating is going up a notch because they've just played Inter, they've lost that game, they've got Torino, they've got Fiorentina and Sampdoria. Those three teams, I'd say, not going through the best of periods, but at the start of the season, you'd look at those teams and think they are the ones that are going to be competing for Europa League,
right,
or maybe even aspiring for more. So it could be quite an unforgiving section of the season for Giampaolo, and it's going to, I think, be a real measure and a test of the faith that Zvonimir Boban, Paolo Maldini and the hierarchy at Milan have in this manager, because at the moment he's putting a lot of square pegs in round holes, trying to fit players who clearly are not comfortable in the positions he's playing and the style he's playing. Also, just want to see more of their new players, like Bennacer, who was very good at Empoli last year, player of the tournament in the African Cup of Nations, which he won with Algeria. I think that's mystified some of the people at the club that he's only started one game so far. Teo Hernandez came on, final 20 minutes of the derby, and looked pretty good. Why wasn't he starting from the beginning? And again, we saw flashes from Leao, big signing from Lille, 25 million. That suggests that there is room for this team to grow, room for it to improve, but that improvement needs to come very, very quickly.
Mm. Milan Corley, as the Gazetta put it. Nice turn of phrase that. A 2-0 win anyway for Inter. It was a busy game, actually. Two goals, another two were disallowed, and Inter hit the frame of the goal three times as well.
Mm.
So pretty dominant performance.
Yeah, very dominant from start to finish. There were a couple of scares that Inter had towards the end of the first half, purely from Milan counterattacks, which came from Inter mistakes. But you had D'Ambrosio somehow hit the post from point-blank range. Candreva, in stoppage time, hit the post. And were it not for Donnarumma, who's been Milan's best player so far this season, you know, they could have gone in at half-time behind. It could have been a hell of a lot worse. I wouldn't even say that Inter were very good. They just took care of business. And I think, again, when you contrast what Conte has done and how instantly he's been able to get this team to play in the style that he wants it to, and also integrate lots of new signings who are contributing goals and performances, that makes what Giampaolo is doing all the kind of more damning. Because, again, you look around the league, there are lots of new managers in new jobs with lots of new players to play with. And you can already see with, you know, we'll get to Juventus in a minute, Aaron Ramsey scoring on his debut. You know, you look at Napoli, you've got Giovanni Di Lorenzo, Lozano, all making impacts. None of these Milan players that they've signed in the summer are either playing or making an impact.
James, we all saw Conte's Inter in the Champions League being very underwhelming. They played Dudelange, or who was it?
Slavia Prague.
Slavia Prague. How big was that performance in that context? Because Lukaku, for example, didn't look very good. Conte as a manager hadn't looked very good. How important was it to suggest, you know, that Inter are indeed on track by beating Milan in a convincing fashion?
It was big because the doubts started to creep in. Because Inter, a little bit like Milan, have had quite a soft start to the season in terms of the opposition that they played so far. So this was seen as the first big test after that disappointing result against Slavia Prague. And Conte was very self-critical, in part, I think, to take some of the responsibility away from the players. But he said, you know, I'm a donkey. I'm the biggest donkey of them all. You know, if this was a class, you know, put the dunce hat on me. I'll go sit in the corner. And I haven't slept.
Do me a favour. Kick this butt.
Yeah. And I haven't slept since. And he's just been working at it. And he said that were it not for that performance, I mean, this is a classic kind of pop psychology from an Italian manager. If we hadn't had that poor performance, maybe we do not put in the performance that we did on Saturday night. Mm. And it was the kind of lesson, the wake-up call that we needed for this game.
Regarding Antonio Conte, I mean, I think that time will put into perspective what he did at Chelsea, because that was pretty good. And I think that he's this kind of manager that doesn't need a lot of time to do whatever he wants to do. He gets the team ready straight away for Juventus in his first season. I think that he finished the season unbeaten.
Yeah.
And then for Italy, he was very good from the very beginning. Same thing for Chelsea. He won the title in the first season as well. I don't know if you see him winning the season again with Inter in his first.
I think so, because, you know, they have margins for improvement. It's clear. I mean, even with Lukaku. Lukaku, I don't think, has played particularly well in his first four games for the club. And yet he's scoring goals.
You know, three
and four.
Mm.
And, you know, this is someone who had back spasms before the Slavia Prague game. Still, I think, in terms of mobility, not the best. And he's still learning to play with new teammates. Once he gets firing, and he's fit and in form, you know, that is quite the proposition. And we also have to see what Conte does with Alexis as well, because if he can reawaken what we saw in Alexis at Udinese, at Barcelona, at Arsenal, then that could be pretty tasty as well. But I think the biggest contrast of all in this derby was the difference in quality between one midfield and the other, because I think Inter's midfield at the moment looks like the best it's been since the treble.
Inter are in action. Inter 2 points clear at the top of the table right now of Juventus. They'll be taking on Lazio on Wednesday night, while Tuesday sees Juve travel to Eugenio Corini's Brescia.
Mario Balotelli.
Mario Balotelli.
He's back.
Never trained so hard in my life, says
Mario. Or trained at all.
Trained at all. Right? I've been training, says Mario.
At what? No. We don't know.
No.
He's as fit as when he was at City when he was 20 or something like that.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How much is that saying, though?
Well, anyway, Juventus, meantime, are coming off a 2-1 win against Verona, which saw, as you mentioned, Aaron Ramsey scoring on his debut, although admittedly it did go off Corey Gunter's bum.
It did.
Yeah.
And I think Maurizio Sarri, he gave him an hour. Mm-hmm. And I think he was not critical, but on the sideline, I don't think he was completely happy with what his midfielders were doing, because when Juventus lost the ball, they didn't go after and try and win it back straight away. They instead did what they always do under Allegri, which was sort of back off and go and defend in their own penalty area. And Sarri just does not want that at all. But yeah, I think it was pretty encouraging from Ramsey, particularly some of the combinations that he had with Ronaldo and whoever the fullback was on the side that he was playing. And he'll be better for that. But again, you know, Juventus, they had to come back from behind in this game. Buffon had
bizarre way that Verona scored. So this was really early on.
Oh,
it's
amazing.
A penalty to Verona.
And Samuele Di Carmine, who used to play for QPR, hits the post.
Bounces back out to one of his teammates, who hits the crossbar.
Yeah, and then Miguel Veloso, from like 35 yards out, most difficult chance of all, bends it to the top corner.
E palla sulla traversa, ancora Verona rete! Faraoni, strepitoso!
The fans, the Tifosi had to, or at least the Ultras, had threatened both before the Atletico game and indeed for this one that they were going to cause trouble after Juve had basically reported certain Capi Ultra to the police for an attempt to blackmail them. But the game passed without incident whatsoever?
Yeah, I mean, there was some chance, give us our Ultras back and things like that. The Cudva Sud wasn't empty as some people anticipated it to be. There were no flags. And there was a very big police presence behind the Sud. But yeah, funny that they should threaten Juventus after, you know, essentially been turned in for threatening them.
Yeah.
At least they're
so
consistent.
There were problems with the fans at the Atalanta-Fiorentina game with some racist chants for... Right, and the referee suspending the game there for 3 minutes.
Yes, following the protocol. He was on the side of the pitch where Dalbert was the victim of this abuse. And the referee, I think it was Daniele Orsato, you can see quite clearly on the labiale, the lip read, that he says the next time we're going off.
Right.
And Atalanta have actually just put out a statement disassociating themselves from racism, showing solidarity with Dalbert. And I think it's been quite interesting that this weekend, for example, Inter and Milan, they made it the derby against racism. And I think the press release that Milan put out in particular was very strongly worded. Ivan Gazidis and Elliot and the club want to come out and kind of take a lead where there is no leadership against this issue. So I think that is a promising sign. In the meantime, however, these incidents continue, and it would be quite easy for someone to predict that, you know, Juventus Brescia, Balotelli making his debut, you don't want to see it, but it would not come as a surprise if a story coming out of that game would be some kind of racist incident, which is a shame.
Yeah, it would be a terrible
shame. It's become all too predictable.
Well, particularly with a group of the fans who are looking to cause trouble for the club.
Well, and also, like, again, in this Atalanta statement, you know, I commend them for coming out and condemning it, but at the same time, it's just a few idiots. It's not these idiots. You tot them up. They're hundreds, they're thousands over the course of the season. To come out that this is a minority, if it's happening every week, it's normal, which is abnormal in 2019.
Mm. Atalanta-Fiorentina finished 2-2, featuring the first Fiorentina goal from Franck Ribéry.
I have to say, I thought he looked amazing. For a 36-year-old, for 70 minutes, he looked fantastic. And the goal, that volley with his left foot, the cross by Chiesa, and their relationship looks so good already.
Fiorentina still without a win in, what, 8 months, is it?
Bottom. 18 games, James. It's the worst run since 1938. That's the only time they've done worse, when they were on a 21-game winless streak.
Right. Bottom of the table.
And they were 2-0 up in this game. So, yeah, Atalanta, you know, as we see, keep going behind.
Right.
But unlike against Dinamo Zagreb,
right,
they came back again in this one.
You know what? We probably should move on, but we have to have a quick word. What was the reaction to Atalanta's, I mean, after all the expectations of how much they could surprise Europe, how nice an illustration it would be of the kind of very positive, forward-thinking football they play, to see them on the bigger stage, and they end up getting beaten 4-0 by Dinamo Zagreb. What was the reaction?
Well, at the same time, it wasn't particularly critical, because it's like just being there is a massive success.
Hmm.
And it's match day one. And yeah, there are still three winnable games for them in that group. The two against Shakhtar and the other one against Zagreb at San Siro. So I don't think they've been written off. They found it very difficult to explain what happened to them. I think they built it up so much in their minds that when they went behind early, they struggled to react. The game that they had planned was not, you know, what they then came up against.
Right.
Because Dinamo Zagreb, who coached by a former Spezia manager, completely ripped up his playbook and did something else. And they didn't react at all. And I'd like to think that they'd be better prepared come the next time around, because they know, yeah, that ace has been played. But I think just mentally, and it's something that Maurizio Sarri was saying in relation to Juventus at the weekend, is that Champions League games, it's not the physical recovery, it's the mental toll that these games take. Because, you know, we've seen it across the last few seasons. The number of games which suffer in one leg, a blowout, and then second game or whatever, there's a comeback and something like that. And this just seems to be a
general
trend.
Why are you looking at Jaws? Why? Why are you looking at Jaws?
Really,
just leave it alone, James.
I really dislike you.
I'm sorry, Jules.
I think Barcelona should carry that fame now.
He had two.
Seriously.
We only had one. He had two.
Wait, what? Mias as the representative of La Liga.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not a Barcelona fan. Right.
Two embarrassments. Yes. We only had
one. Tell you what, time for a quick word from producer Ben.
Thanks very much, Jimbo. Here's Lee Price on the line from Paddy Power. Lee, let's start with the Bundesliga. Lewandowski's averaging almost two goals a game in Germany. So will he be taking home the golden shoe at the end of the season?
Well, for a gong that's given out for the most league goals scored across Europe's top divisions, Lewandowski's nine strikes given him a flying start. And yet, he's not our favourite for the most prestigious footwear since Cinderella's slipper. In fact, we put him behind two guys who haven't even scored yet in the league. Although, to be fair, they are the greatest of all time, Lionel Messi and future superstar Kylian Mbappe. We make Lewandowski joint third favourite at 5-1 alongside Cristiano Ronaldo, who has at least notched twice so far this season in Serie A.
Over to Serie A, Fiorentina have got Frank Ribery, but they're still bottom of the league. Surely they can't go down, can they?
We think they'll be okay, with or without Ribery actually. We make Verona and Lecce both odds on to go down 4-7 to relegate them Serie A, with Spal the most likely to join them at 11-10. As for Fiorentina, they're 18-1 to go down, way out of relegation betting. And in fact, they're odds on to get back to winning ways tomorrow night against Sampdoria.
And finally, let's go to Spain. Next weekend is the Madrid derby at the Wanda. How's this one going to go?
Yeah, it's been an interesting start to the season in Spain, hasn't it? And this is a huge game, clearly. It would be anyway, but for Cindy and Zidane and Real Madrid, it's a huge chance to get some momentum behind them. We don't think they will, though. Atleti, the favourites here at 13-10. Real are 15-8, so still not a long price away from home, and the draw's 23-10. Else, a certain Jose Mourinho might be making headlines this weekend.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply, and when the fun stops, stop. Many thanks to Andrew Turner, Andrew Lang, Steve Malanga, some of the many listeners who sent us in questions. Let's see. Andrew Turner says, is Pochettino still a big target for Real Madrid and Bayern if stroke when he becomes available? Or has he lost some of his shine and been overtaken by the likes of Nagelsmann for these super clubs?
If Poch is available when Zinedine Zidane leaves, then he's going to be a candidate for the Real Madrid job. But I think that if Zidane leaves in the foreseeable future, Jose Mourinho will be probably the Real Madrid manager, because he's the best one available.
Right. I saw Raul and Allegri also mentioned this week before the Sevilla win, when it looked like maybe Zidane might be going very, very soon.
Allegri turned them down a year ago and then was sacked by his club. That's the way the cookie crumbles. But, you know, there's been contact there in the past is the point that I'm making.
Among the names mentioned for the Barcelona job has been Xavi as well.
And Victor Valdés, who is in the Barcelona Academy, in the B team.
Is he? Right,
yeah, he's there, and he's doing a good job, actually. And he seems to be one of the biggest admirers of Guardiola and Johan Cruyff's philosophy. So he seems to be a good fit.
Xabi Alonso as well is with the Real Madrid B team.
Wow. Okay, excellent.
So Nagelsmann, according to Nagelsmann, turned down Real Madrid last year.
Right.
Now there's no chance of him leaving, but if it's between Pochettino, Nagelsmann, I'd say from Bayern's point of view, they'd be more interested in Pochettino, because A, he's more gettable in theory, and B, I think they had doubts about Nagelsmann just being a little bit too young, and extricating him now from Leipzig would be all but impossible. So it's not a like-for-like comparison, if you will.
Okay. Did you turn down Real Madrid, James?
I didn't, no. I didn't. I don't turn things down. I think that much must be clear by now. Andrew Lang wants to know. He says, after reading Rafa's piece on Nagelsmann, where was that, Rafa?
In The Athletic.
Nice, James. Okay. I'd be really interested in knowing anything further about his mindset or ambition for Leipzig or post-Leipzig. Do you think he'd be a success in the Premier League or Liga?
Well, I mean, he's still only 32. He's still only at his second...
insane, isn't it?
That's amazing. Yeah.
At his second club.
Right.
I think it's a natural progression for him to go from Hoffenheim to Leipzig. And
right.
I think by his own admission, he felt that it was a good place to grow because perhaps he wasn't quite ready to go abroad and take a bigger, more pressurized club. So everything I've seen from him so far, both in terms of the results, but also the way he carries him, the way that players who work with him talk about him afterwards, suggests that he is a very, very special manager who could probably, because he's adaptable, intelligent enough to succeed just about anywhere he goes.
Mm.
So I have no doubt that this guy is going to be with us for a very long time, winning big things.
May I say that perhaps not in the case of Nagelsmann, but normally if a manager is ready from the beginning. In fact, the first year of Pep Guardiola was fantastic. The first year of Jose Mourinho was amazing as well. So I don't think that the experience is a very positive characteristic in managers. Sometimes youth is good because they are more up to date with training drills. They are more up to date with plenty of ideas, and they can communicate on a very good level with the players as well.
Give me another example then.
Jose Mourinho.
No.
Conte,
another one.
No, many. I got
Conte's
many.
First season.
Yeah, at Siena he did well. Arezzo, first of all.
He wasn't 32.
Arezzo, he got sacked.
Yeah.
Okay. As did Maurizio Sarri.
Okay.
Give me another one, because you named the two best of their generation.
Well, Pochettino.
I mean, you have
Javier Clemente.
Pochettino, Espanyol, was not a huge success. You can't compare it with Mourinho and Guardiola.
Who are the managers who got better over time then?
All of them, it's by definition. Jules, the more experience you get, the better you get.
Luis Van Gaal.
With the exception of
Johan Cruyff. Their best period was when they were young.
Can we go back in the 1950s as well?
No, I'm telling you.
Johan Cruyff.
Necessarily an either or scenario.
Saki is a great shot.
Experience is not necessarily.
It's not an either or scenario.
No, not at all.
Álvaro's point is correct that you have a lot of managers who come in and have almost their best times right at the start.
From the beginning.
When they're 13. Not when they're 30. That's the point I'm making with Nagelsmann. Not when they're 30. And
Nagelsmann
when
is an outlier in that sense, yeah.
But there's other young... I'm not sure if Eddie Howe...
Look at 30, Dominic German. I mean, what's happened to him?
Yeah.
I think there will always be
the Eddie Howe of the
special situations. If you're a former icon at the club and then you take over from within the club, I think you have a better chance of succeeding than coming from
no, but he has actually done well.
Coming from the outside in. If you're Nagelsmann a year ago, you know, you're 31 and you've just coached Hoffenheim for 3.5 years. If you have the offer from Real Madrid, if you're smart, you don't take it because you know Real Madrid is going to be a bit of a shambles. And your reputation might go, and you're not quite ready for that yet.
Only thing I'm saying is that the experience is not necessarily a virtue when it comes to managers. Didier Deschamps, a French guy, at Monaco, he did fantastic from the beginning.
They finished 15th the first season. They didn't win a game in the first seven days.
And then he reached the Champions League final in 2004.
But
experience by itself is not a virtue. Otherwise, Kerbishly and Pardew and all these guys and Big Sam would be in huge demand.
Yes.
But I think talent plus experience is a strong combination.
Sometimes talent plus freshness can be as effective as talent plus experience. That's what those examples tell us. And you can't deny the existence of those examples because, I mean, it's incontrovertible the way that people like Guardiola came in. Yes, they're special, but those are the cases when it works.
Yeah, that's true.
Here's a question from Steve Malanga, which is, thanks, Steve. Can you give us a quick chance to mention, just as we wrap up, Napoli? He says, is Llorente the big man Napoli need to add balance to their attack, or is this just a short run of good luck? They were involved in a big 4-1 win at Lecce, weren't they? He scored, didn't he? Llorente, he got 2, I think.
He's been brilliant.
Yeah.
Scored 2, won a penalty. You think he scored second goal against Liverpool. He also set up one of Mertens' goals on his debut against Sampdoria. I think for a centre-forward, they're a great team to play for because of the number of chances that they create. But what was really interesting about the weekend's game was Ancelotti made 8 changes. And I must say, you know, Ancelotti, I actually do think he is... He's not in decline. I think he is getting better with age.
It's almost like he's getting better with experience.
That team is...
he's still quite young.
That team plays really sophisticated brand of football. And it completely explains why managers kind of get really frustrated with journalists saying, what system do you play? Do you play 4-3-3? Do you play 4-2-3? That is a very kind of amorphous team, which, you know, depending where the ball is, depending what the situation is, yeah, that's what determines the configuration that you see on the pitch. Fabian Ruiz again.
And Eric Abidal was there to watch him for
Barcelona.
Barcelona, potentially. Yes. If you're Fabian Ruiz right now, you don't leave Napoli to go to Barcelona.
I don't think so.
No,
you. Since in that game, he played right wing, but essentially he's coming in playing right midfield, left wing. It's a bit where he's at left back. Yeah, total football. Amazing.
And he's got not only the technique, but he's pretty strong for how. Think he is. He seems to be a very light player.
But robust.
He's really, really robust as well. And he's going to start definitely for Spain in the Euro 2020 because the new manager, Robert Moreno, really likes him.
Mm. All right. Napoli currently third in Serie A.
Top scorers.
The bottom of Serie A.
Fiorentina, Sampdoria.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. Anyway, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the midweek round. There's fixtures, of course, in France and Spain this midweek. And Thursday's Totally Football Show can round up anything significant that happens in those. But the guys will be back next Tuesday. Alvaro, James, Rafa, Julien, all looking forward by then to another round of Champions League action. So hopefully you'll be joining us for that. Listen, I hope you enjoyed this show. Many thanks to the guys for being with us. We'll see you soon.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter. And make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.